Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen. Our producers, by the way, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stanzel and Henry Frain is at the controls. During the first hour of the show today, we'll take your questions on personal finance, something we do once a month on the show. David Sinnoh is our guest. He has long time been advising people on personal financial matters. He's really good at talking about the macro issues and how they relate to the micro. He's a professor of finance here at the University of Illinois, and he's here to take your questions. If you'd like to join us, we'll start talking in general about the state of the economy, but then happy to answer your phone calls. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. If you're anywhere in the Midwest here, if you're listening on the air, or if you're listening on the web anywhere in the continental U.S., you can use our toll-free line. Also, we have an email address. I like to give that out, too. If you'd like to write us your question by email, the address talk@will.uiuc.edu anytime during this hour. David Sinnoh, good morning.
Well, good morning, Jack, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. There are so many topics we could discuss this morning, a surging stock market, mortgage rates that once again have pierced the 6% level, that's not happy news, an economy that appears to be gaining steam, that is happy news, in spite of difficult job prospects, just lots and lots of different issues. However, I'd like to begin by reminding our listeners about some, well, what I would call them economic realities, by beginning with a quick look at our national debt. That's a happy subject. As of this morning, you'll be happy to know that the U.S. government owed the holders of U.S. Treasury instruments the sum of $6.83 trillion. Interestingly enough, if we write that amount out in numerical form, I did that this morning, that's really a 13-digit number. And also, the national debt is growing at a rate of $1.6 billion per day. Considering there are approximately 290 million people in the United States, that equivalent is about $23,000 per person. So, Jack, I would appreciate it very much if you would kindly pay my share, my lovely wife's Carol's share, and, of course, my daughter Renee and Megan. That would be very nice as well. That's almost a cool $100,000, but I know that at WILL you don't have any problem with fundraising or anything. You're well, extremely well paid, so if you would just kind of gift that for me, I would really appreciate it.
Will you take stock options?
Well, I'm not sure about those stock options.
All right.
It depends on what kind. Well, in any event, it's estimated that over the next 12 months, U.S. tax revenues will approximate $2 trillion. And U.S. outlays, that's us, we're going to spend this money, will be about $2.5 trillion. Where does the $2 trillion of revenue really come from? Well, about half of it is personal income tax. Almost 50% of the revenues that we take in are from personal income tax. Only 10% is corporate. About $200 billion of it is corporate. And here's the big number that people forget about unless you are a working individual in the United States. $700 billion of revenues, or 35%, are Medicare and Social Security taxes. And the remaining 5%, or about $100 billion, that's just a little bit of change, comes from a variety of miscellaneous sources, estate taxes, gift taxes, those types of areas. But it's a small number in the overall budget. On the expenditure side, over the next 12 months, I mentioned that we're expected, or Congress is expected to appropriate, about $2.5 trillion of governmental outlays. Medicare and Medicaid will approximate $540 billion, or about 21% of all expenditures. That's the biggest. Medicare and Medicaid. Now, Medicare, of course, is our primary health care provider for folks over 65. Medicaid is a jointly funded federal and state program. So the federal government puts in money, the states put in money, and they ensure the health of the poorest Americans, and they also provide long-term care for Americans who can't afford it themselves and who need it. So we've got Medicare and Medicaid over 20% of the entire governmental outlays. The second largest expenditure, very, very close behind, is Social Security. That's estimated over the next 12 months at approximately $530 billion, or 20% of government expenditures. So we've already eaten up, essentially, well over 40% of the total outlays. And if we add Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid together, that's over $1 trillion. That's more than all of the personal income taxes that we're expected to collect from individuals over the next 12 months. The third largest expenditure is defense, estimated at $400+ billion, or 15% of government outlays. And rapidly breathing down everyone's neck is interest on the national debt, approximating $300 billion, or about 12% of government outlays. Now, $150 billion is made up of federal retirement benefits, VA benefits, unemployment compensation benefits, all these miscellaneous benefit programs. That's about 6%. So in other words, 75% of all government outlays, that's us, we're the government that we're going to spend, fall in these above categories. And our defense outlays, of course, are growing. Now, interestingly enough, it's estimated that what are we going to spend for education? Here's an interesting number, $32 billion, or 2% of all government outlays are going to be placed in the educational arena. And I think that almost everyone would agree that that's an unfortunate number. So as we can quickly see, a tremendous percentage of our budget outlays are really locked in. And, of course, the question becomes who's going to pay for it and how? Well, the who, of course. A little bit of it is us, obviously our children and our grandchildren. The how is going to be by ratcheting up the cost of funds. Now, this could come in two forms. The most likely form, an increase in interest rates, because the government's going to have a very voracious appetite for money. They're going to actually bid up the price of money, which makes it more expensive for you and I. That's why I don't look for much of a fall in mortgage rates at this point in time. So if you are waiting for a substantial setback in mortgage rates before you refinance, I don't think that's going to happen in the next few days. So they're still very, very reasonable. So if you've been waiting, maybe you ought to jump in and take advantage of mortgage rates as they sit at the current time. And indeed, I think that's what's happening because we're seeing another sort of flood of people saying, oh my goodness, I don't want to miss this mortgage rate floor. It's not quite what it was 3, 4, 5 months ago, but maybe I better jump in and take advantage of those interest rates. So I think that's extremely important. Now, I think there's lots of positive news out there as well. You have to remember that we're a $10 trillion economy, and we're growing. In other words, the sum of all goods and services produced in this country is well over $10 trillion. That's a big-time number, and that's on an annual basis. So that's a number that's growing, and at the same time, we're finally seeing first-time unemployment claims actually dropping. If you look at any newspaper in the United States, for the first time, you're seeing many, many more job want ads in there. You're actually seeing that whole area finally expanding. Retail sales continue brisk. They continue to be strong. They were down a little bit, but that was really in the automobile sector. Otherwise, they were very strong. And corporate profits are improving. In fact, corporate profits are coming in much better than expected. And people are betting that in spite of a stubborn job growth, the economy really is finally turning the corner. And obviously, I think this accounts for the rapid run-up in stock values that we've seen really since the June of 2002 lows. Since that period of time, and just for example, this year, just taking this year, the S&P 500 up 19%. By the way, when we talk about the S&P 500, the largest company now in the United States based on what is called market capitalization. We take the closing price of the stock yesterday times all of the outstanding shares. Microsoft is now number one. General Electric has now fallen to number two. And that surging Walmart giant is number three. So the S&P 500 up 19% for the year. The Russell 2000, those small companies, that index that I continue to talk about, up, imagine this, 38% for the year. Of course, it had a lot to recover, but 38% is a pretty impressive number. Tech stocks, even better, 45% for the year. And even the Nikkei index, which has just been mired for more than 10 years at dirt cheap levels, is up 27% for the year. So that's very, well, let's call it heartening for stock market investors. So after three horrific years on the market, stock investors obviously are cheered by these results. And I think that it's highly likely that based upon a surging economy, we're going to see some additional run-ups. I don't think there's any question about that. So one other point I'd like to make, starting in 2004, at least as of January 1, for those folks who unfortunately pass away in 2004, at least if they have estates of $1.5 million or less, there will be no federal estate tax levied on estates of $1.5 million or less. This year, the number is $1 million. It's actually moving up to $1.5 million, which really covers more than 98% of all Americans. So there's a little bit of duck soup. We can talk about economy, stock markets, estate taxes, interest rates, etc., whatever our wonderful listeners would like to talk about. I'm delighted to try to tackle those kinds of questions.
Very good. Phone numbers again, if you'd like to call in and ask your questions for David Sinnoh, anything having to do with personal finance, money management, retirement issues, etc., 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free anywhere else in the Midwest or in the U.S. Actually, if you're listening on the web, you can use our toll-free line as well, 800-222-9455. We also have an email address that we'd be happy to take your questions via. That is talk@uiuc.edu. Well, a momentary pause in the calls here, Dave. The employment numbers, I think you mentioned, are very interesting because that's been the big sort of bugaboo in the economy.
No question about it. That's been very tough. And if you talk to college graduates, they're still finding it very tough. And, of course, those unemployment numbers don't reflect the fact that a number of people have actually dropped out of the market or are clearly underemployed. What is positive, however, is actually first-time claims for unemployment has significantly dropped below the 400,000, sort of a magic number there. If we look at unemployment statistics nationally, they seem to be dropping a bit. And again, when we look at the desire for decent-paying jobs now first appearing in major metropolitan newspapers, that as well as positive. So the stock market naturally picks up on all of that. And remember, the stock market, when you see a surge in the market, what that really is saying is we're looking 6 to 12 months down the road. That's what the market is telling us. The stock market with these surges is telling us that things 6 to 12 months down the road economically are going to be better. And, of course, that is interfacing with a presidential election, which is going to put additional pressure on the administration, certainly this year, to show some positive economic numbers.
We have a call to talk with in Chicago. We'll go first to them. Again, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. Chicago listener on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. Yes, I had a question because the Senate just passed their approval of the Iraqi reconstruction package on the requirement that half of it would have to be a loan. And I thought according to the Geneva Convention, the invading country has to be responsible for the reconstruction of the country. So would the Iraqi people be able to sue us?
You're asking an extraordinary question far beyond my level of expertise.
Oh.
But what a wonderful question, however. You know, there are several assumptions that you've made, and I really don't even want to go there about invading and not invading, et cetera, and who's responsible, et cetera. But I think at the current time, obviously, the president wants to posture in such a way that a substantial portion of the reconstruction is a loan, and a portion of it is going to be just a grant. And the president really would like more grant and less loan. That's really the bottom line, but Congress doesn't want to go along with that. So you've raised some interesting questions. What would happen in the international courts, in the Court of The Hague? But you know, that would take years and years and years to decide. But maybe someone who has a lot more information about that can call in and pontificate on it. I just hesitate to, but it's an extraordinary question.
I think it's a topic for another show, definitely.
Wonderful.
Okay, because I'm just thinking of the cost that's going to be involved. And will this be factored in, because I just see along the way that the war on terror has really been a boom for lawyers, and I just see incredible amounts of expenses going to lawyers. And I mean, I don't think you should dismiss the cost, because look how much Ken Starr cost us. So, I mean,
yeah,
let's factor that in, too.
Okay. Well, I think these are topics that we can take up on another hour, because, you know, it's a little beyond the purview of this particular
Thank you.
This morning. Thanks very much for the call.
To give you an idea, however, of $85 billion number, that's sort of a number that's been thrown out.
Yeah.
That's a number that's estimated to be similar to the number for providing really satisfying prescription drug coverage for people over 65 on an annual basis, $85 billion. So I'm just throwing that out as an example of the kinds of dollars we're talking about here.
Or you mentioned that the federal outlay on education is about $23
billion. Yeah, just a paltry number.
Yeah.
A paltry number.
Okay. Well, let's go on next and talk with a Champagne listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I have a how things work type question on mutual funds. When a mutual fund, an equity fund, sells its underlying shares for a capital gain, they are required to distribute that to their mutual fund shareholders.
That's correct.
But if they sell, which has happened a lot lately, for a capital loss, as I understand it, they may not distribute those capital loss to their shareholders. In fact, I think they have to carry them forward on their books to offset future capital gains. Is that correct?
That's my understanding also.
My question was, if it's not distributed and carried forward, is that reflected on the share price of the fund, like undistributed capital gains, or is it just hidden somewhere?
An unrecognized capital loss? Well, no, the capital loss, if they actually recognize a capital loss and sell, that would have an impact on your overall share value.
So it would reduce the share value if somebody sold it before future gains were used to offset that.
That's right. That's correct.
Okay, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are welcome, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Your questions on personal finance for David Sinnoh.
You know, one of the difficulties today, Jack, is have people miss the market. Awful lot of money has been sitting on the sideline, and we know what those interest rates are bringing, whether you have money in an IRA, whether you have money at a local money market account, whatever. And in fact, if you look at the Wall Street Journal today at national money market rates, 7-day rates, well, the word is paltry again. We seem to be using that word a good deal, well below 1%. And the question becomes, have I missed an opportunity to invest in the stock market? And the answer is no, I don't think so. I think that you can invest in the stock market by simply averaging in, as I usually recommend, over a 12 or 18-month period of time. And again, I remind listeners that for those who are going to invest in the stock market, we have to look at it over a very long period of time, a minimum of 15 to 20 years. And then when you look at investing in a market over that period of time, then this momentary surge since June of 2002, for example, where we've really reached our lows and have now moved quite a bit from those lows, they really don't have that big an impact when we look over these very long periods of time. So, again, if you want to invest, it's always a good time to invest. But, again, we have to make sure that we spread our time horizon to at least a 15, 20-year time horizon.
Very good. Another caller waiting for us, line number one, listener in Urbana. Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah.
Years ago, I worked for a nonprofit organization that didn't have a retirement plan, but just a couple of years before I left, they set up a variable annuity program where you could contribute your own money toward a tax-sheltered variable annuity. The money has grown over time. I left the organization long ago, so I don't have there's not a problem with taking the money out, but I'm just wondering what the consequences might be to move from that kind of thing. Is it possible to move that kind of money to a a Roth IRA or something like that.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. Under this variable annuity program, was the money that you put into the variable annuity after-tax money or pre-tax money?
I think it was taken out of my paycheck, and I think it was pre-tax money.
All right. Well, then you are probably under an actual employer-sponsored plan. Mm-hmm. It sounds as though that they had an actual plan, perhaps something like a 403B plan, which is not unusual for a nonprofit organization. If indeed your variable annuity is with pre-tax dollars, and indeed it was under the ambit or the jurisdiction of some type of sponsored plan by your place of employ, you could take that money and you could roll it, if you will, into some kind of self-directed program, an IRA program, for example. You might also be able to roll it into a Roth. Keep in mind, however, that if you roll it into a Roth, the value of that variable annuity would be subject to being taxed today. So let's just take an example where you took $10,000 of pre-tax money. You never paid any tax on it. You invested it in an annuity product, and today that annuity product is worth $25,000. All right? You with me so far?
Yep.
Okay. Now, the first question is, what if I liquidate inside the program my variable annuity? Are there any surrender charges or expenses on the product itself? This has nothing to do with IRS. This has to do with the issue of whether or not there is some type of rear-end surrender fee, charge, load, etc., if you liquidate your variable annuity before its time. Many of them have disappearing surrender charges where you're required to hold variable annuity products 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 years. Follow me?
I'm okay. Well beyond that sort of thing.
All right, so you probably don't have any expenses and charges which would be initiated by the insurance company. If that is the case, if you actually liquidated the variable annuity and rolled it to your Roth IRA, the $25,000, as an example, would now be subject to being taxed. You can put it inside the Roth IRA, but you got to pay tax on it. Mm-hmm. So you pay one-time tax on the $25,000. So you've got to have some money sitting around to pay the tax, because maybe that additional $25,000 layers you into maybe a 25 or 30% tax bracket, because you have to pay your tax on it. And now the money is sitting inside a Roth IRA, and at least under current law, that money will continue to grow tax-free forever.
So it's a question of paying tax now or tax later.
That's one of the questions. That's one of the questions, paying it now or paying it later. There are also some rules whether or not you are eligible to roll money into a Roth IRA, and that has to do with how much money you make. And typically, if your adjusted gross income, the number on the bottom line of page one of your tax return, is less than $100,000, then you are eligible to roll money into a Roth IRA. The beauty of a Roth IRA as compared to a regular IRA is that there are no minimum distribution requirements. In a traditional or regular IRA, of course, you have some minimum distribution requirements. At the age of 70 and a half, you have to start taking money out. In a Roth, you don't have to. However, there is an advantage of going into a traditional IRA, and that is that's a tax-free, tax-deferred rollover. In other words, you could roll into an IRA, you pay no tax currently, but you must start taking money out at 70 and a half.
Okay.
Follow that?
Yep.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Pleasure talking with you.
Bye.
Thanks very much for the call. Well, we have another caller getting lined up here. I wanted to ask something. You mentioned about the federal deficit being $6.830 trillion. And I remember just a couple of years ago we were talking about eliminating the federal deficit totally. And I guess my question is, if the economy turns around, I mean, it seems to me this is the basis for what happens with the federal tax revenues, the state tax revenues. All these deficits that we're talking about depend on revenue in the economy. So if the economy does turn around, can that disappear in a couple of years? I mean, are we looking at a different scenario?
Well, we certainly should be looking at in terms of budget deficits, mm-hmm. that those becoming squeezed.
Yeah.
I mean, currently looking at revenues out 12 months without a tremendous amount of recovery, we're looking at substantial deficits, especially because of Homeland Security and all of the things that have occurred. However, if the economy and the engine actually gets revved up as a result of these tax cuts, because historically when we have tax cuts, more revenue does come in to the federal treasuries. That's the way it has been. There has been economic expansion. That's the whole idea, that it's very possible that these deficits, or at least these budget deficits on an annual basis, mm-hmm. might shrink. We've just got a long way to go. When you start to look at a $7 trillion number, it's a big number. What kind of frame of reference can we compare a $7 trillion number to? Well, here's an idea. If we took all of the stocks everybody owns and in that are traded on all of the U.S. exchanges, I think that number today, that entire market value, is somewhere between $13 and $14 trillion. So that would just wipe out half,
mm-hmm.
all right?
Yeah.
If everybody would just give half their stock positions away and say, here, federal government, I'm in a very jolly mood today. Take half of my position. We could wipe out the deficit. I'm just trying to give some way of thinking about that
sure.
number. It's a
yeah.
big number.
Yeah.
Such a big number.
We have a caller in St. Joseph to talk with on line number one next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning, David.
Good morning.
My concern is how to increase interest we earn on savings. And presently we have a chunk of money in what we call our reserve fund, which is in a money market fund.
Yes.
Which the annualized yield is about 0.7%.
Exactly.
We also have money in an annuity that's put in a total bond market index portfolio that's earning roughly 4% annualized yield. And what I'm thinking about doing is reducing the amount of money I have in my money market fund and put it in a stock fund. And if emergency comes up, just withdraw money from that total bond market index fund in the annuity, which, and the money's available within roughly 48 hours. And I just to eliminate so much money sitting, doing nothing essentially, that's our reserve fund. And I would keep a minimum amount of money to keep the money market fund open just because it's in a family of funds and I move stuff around occasionally. So, you know, that's my plan. I just wondered, I know there'll be a taxable event if I remove it from the annuity, but I just feel that's worth it. We seldom dip into the reserve fund.
Let me ask you a couple of questions so I understand. You have an annuity.
Right.
And it's a single premium deferred annuity where it continues to grow at a certain interest rate each year?
Well, it's a variable annuity where I invest in mutual funds.
All right, so you have a variable.
Right.
And have you taken money out of that fund?
No.
All right. And are you thinking of accessing that money?
No.
All right, so that's just a variable annuity. It's invested in stock mutual funds.
Well, that one annuity is primarily just total bond market.
Oh, all right. So your variable annuity is in your total bond market portfolio.
Right.
Do you have any idea of what the average maturity of that particular fund is that you are investing in?
Well, I don't have to. I have to take mandatory withdrawals at age 95.
No, that I understand. I have a different question. The actual fund itself mm-hmm. that you are invested in, what is the average maturity of the bonds in that particular fund?
Gee, I don't know.
All right, that's an important question. Because if you believe over the next 1 to 5 years that interest rates will be higher than they are today, then what that tells me is that funds that are investing in very long-term bonds today, that their net asset values are likely to go down. In other words, people are buying yields today in bond funds by moving out and purchasing funds that have 15 to 20-year bonds inside them, because that's the only way that you can essentially get a higher interest rate. So you're buying yield by moving way, way, way out on the maturity curve. You follow me?
Yeah.
And what happens is that if interest rates spike up, the value of those bonds move inversely, and the value of those bonds actually go down. So the bond manager will then sell those bonds at lower prices and replace those bonds with higher yielding instruments.
Right.
So I caution listeners to be very careful about the maturity of their bond funds, especially in an interest rate environment that we are in today, where it seems to me more likely than not that interest rates will move up. So here's the bottom line. I'd look at it, and if I was in a bond fund that had an average maturity of greater than 10 years, I'd be concerned, right? Well, so I wouldn't see myself adding to that type of fund.
No, I don't plan to add to
okay.
it. This is the Vanguard Total Bond Market Index Portfolio.
Okay. That's a great fund.
And it's 38% of the assets are invested in corporate
right.
and asset-backed bonds, 33% right. in mortgage-backed securities, and 26% in government bonds.
Right.
But it doesn't say anything about what the average maturity date is. At least I can't find
Actually, you can go to the website, www.vanguard.com,
yeah.
under funds, call up that particular fund, and they'll give you that information.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can go to the website and get it. I've just forgotten what it is.
Oh.
But certainly, if you're going to be in any bond funds in the country, certainly those are some of the finest bond funds to be in. Now, you were telling me that you were going to take money out of your reserves, which are these money market.
That's right.
That's paying about 0.7%.
That's right.
And you wanted to move that into the stock market.
That's right.
All right? And are you going to access asset class or index funds at Vanguard?
Either Vanguard or Fidelity, yes.
Okay. If you are going to average in and access what I call asset class funds, S&P 500, U.S. small company,
right.
large value, small value, I don't have a problem with that so long as you maintain enough in your reserve fund. Because once you move into the stock market, you're in the stock market with that money. And you don't want to access that money. You don't want to get into a position where you are forced to access that money and you're kicking yourself because it's worth less than when you invested it.
No, and I wouldn't be putting that money into a mutual fund where I need to access it. I would still be using, if I needed money in an emergency, I'd just draw money from that total bond market index portfolio.
Okay. All right. So I don't have a problem with your plan.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Good. Thanks, David.
A pleasure.
Right. Thanks very much for the call. We have just about 15 minutes left with David Sinnott, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois, talking about personal finance. Any questions you have are welcome in the time remaining. We have one caller waiting and time for others. 333-9455. That's the Champaign Urbana number. Toll free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Next up, a listener in Lexington on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate your show. I have a question on, for the past 10 years, I've had a SEP plan that has been in a family of funds with MFS, and I'm received recently an additional management fee that I have to pay every year, and I'm getting kind of tired of not only paying a load, but then I get the added insult of a management fee on top of that. And I've always been afraid to move those funds or to a different fund because of penalties or whatever. But can you tell me the ins and outs of what I should be doing? You know, I'm not satisfied with the performance, and I really don't like paying a load for something that's just been costing me money for the last 3 years.
Well, let me tell you what you've done right is you have a SEP IRA. That you've clearly done right because you've saved a lot of taxes and you've presumably put a substantial amount of money away and it's growing tax deferred. I sympathize with you and I find it difficult to understand over long periods of time why people are willing to pay loads on mutual funds and willing to pay excessive management fees. Now, I'm not suggesting that MFS falls into that category. I'm simply saying that there are any number of funds which are low-cost providers which provide a good bang for your buck without excessive management fees and, indeed, no loads. So if you are in MFS funds, the first thing you would need to investigate is what are the surrender fees, if any, if you were to move those funds to a different family of funds. Have you already investigated that?
No, I haven't. I don't know how to go about it.
Well, the easiest way to do that is to call MFS, have a service representative call up your account, and go through each individual mutual fund and ask the question, if you were to liquidate a fund, what are the surrender fees, if any? What are the charges, if any? So you would need to do that with the service representative, fund by fund. Then if you were to move, it's very easy to go to another provider, whether it's a brokerage firm, whether it's a mutual fund company, whether it's a bank. They'll all be delighted to set up a SEP IRA program for you and essentially help you fill out the paperwork even to transfer that money. So you would have a liquidation notice to MFS and then a transfer of those assets into your new provider. Naturally, if you've heard me on this program for a long, long period of time, I'm into mutual fund companies that index and are low-cost providers. I think over long, long periods of time, I just think you're better off rather than trying to outthink some money manager who is hot one day and cold the next. So it's not an arduous process. It's a matter, and it sounds like you've psychologically come to grips with this, if you will. You're now sort of fed up and you want to make a move.
Right, and it's so easy just to say, well, it'll get better next by next year, and then when it doesn't, you feel like you've missed out on opportunities. While I watch other funds, you know, their performance. And the other, I had a second question. It's to find performance of funds. Is something like Morningstar or something, is that a good indicator to watch? Or
well, Morningstar is a great indicator to watch if you are going to invest in actively managed mutual funds. They're the king when it comes to actively managed mutual funds. I simply, in terms of my philosophy, have difficulty with actively managed mutual funds. And when I say an actively managed mutual fund, that's a money manager trying to outperform an index. I think over long periods of time, you're better off simply indexing your money, having some of it in large funds, small funds, value funds, etc., as I've talked about before. But surely Morningstar does provide a lot of good information on individual funds.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much for the call. A couple callers waiting. We'll go next to a Champagne listener on line number one. Good morning.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning.
Morning. I've got a question about investment. I'm planning a move with my family in the next year or so, and then we'll be purchasing a house. So I've been kind of stashing some cash away over the last year, and right now it's just in a savings account. I really liked. I was a little bit skittish about getting into the market with everything going on. So I'm trying to figure out now, you know, I've only got maybe a window of 6 to 18 months to invest this before I'm going to need it to be somewhat liquid. So I was wondering if you had any advice as far as a good way to invest that to get my best bang for the buck.
Okay, well, number one, do not move your money into the stock market. 1 year, 18 months is simply not an appropriate form of time. It just doesn't meet the time horizon requirements, so do not put any money in the stock market. I think probably you ought to go out on a CD shopping spree. I would probably check all of my local institutions, my national institutions, and say, look, if I'm not going to be accessing this money, in need of this money, for a minimum of 12 months, I want to purchase the highest yielding FDIC-insured CD that I can find. And what you will find is that those certificates of deposit are paying more money than U.S. Treasury instruments, and they are equally as safe. So that's probably what I would do. I wouldn't be in a checking account. I wouldn't be in a savings account. I would be looking for the highest rate that an institution will pay. And that probably is a 12-month CD rate.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Another listener on line number three in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm going to draw some money out of a strong, ultra short term bond fund that actually is down some. And would this be a good time to put some money into Vanguard Inflation Protected Bond Fund, or have I missed out on the best times for that?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. What was the purpose of the strong, ultra short term bond fund, which is really a well thought of fund? It's a well thought of fund, so I'm trying to understand why you're going from one to the other.
Oh, well, I I put $24,000 in, and now it's worth $23,000. And we've got some other, you know, fairly short-term funds, so we really don't need it. So I just wanted to get into something that I thought would do better in the future.
Okay, well, again, you're betting on interest rates, but
yes.
Certainly the Vanguard Inflation Protected Fund is a well-thought-of fund.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that Strong has some excellent funds also.
Sure. Uh-huh. But I just noticed that Vanguard Inflation Protected has gone up a lot in the past year, and so I thought, well, maybe I missed out on the best.
Well, you haven't completely missed out on it, but I hesitate to recommend just moving from one bond fund to another. I think you need to rethink that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you talk to the people at Strong
mm-hmm.
and ask them what's going on with that fund? Why am I – and I want to make certain that you understand your own statement that indeed you have less money in that fund today
mm-hmm.
than you did at another point in time.
Yeah.
So I think before you move, I want you to go back and spend some time with a Strong representative. And believe me, I'm not an advocate of Strong or Vanguard here, but I want you to understand what you have
mm-hmm.
and what the prospects for that fund are.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think it's maybe safer to have the inflation protection if interest rates go up, maybe?
Well, it's hard to say. Remember that inflation in this country right now is at 2.2%,
mm-hmm.
all right? And it hasn't moved very much in terms of retail and wholesale inflation. So and no one can really predict where that inflation rate is going to go. Certainly that Vanguard fund is an excellent fund as part of an overall portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just simply hesitate to have you move that unless I understood more about the rest of your portfolio.
I see.
That's the point. You need to have someone make certain, or yourself, that it properly fits in the overall portfolio that you currently have.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the call. We have about 5 minutes left and a couple callers waiting. We'll try to get them both in. We'll go next to a listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello?
Yes.
My question has to do with a unit investment trust that I have with Solomon Smith Barney.
Yes.
I've had it for about 5 years.
Yes.
And as you can imagine, it lost great quantities of money around 2000.
Was the unit investment trust entirely invested in stocks?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is. It is called the Uncommon Values Fund. So that sort of explains what the investment is about.
All right.
15 stocks that, you know, are that a committee decides might or hopes maybe high-producing stocks in the next year or so.
All right.
And it is slowly recovering, but I really question, you know, whether I should continue to keep it or whether I should cut my losses and, you know, go for something else.
And were you sold this by a registered representative, by
yes.
a stockbroker?
Yes.
And what has the stockbroker been telling you?
I have not really asked him what to do. Well, actually, I think, yes, he is in favor of keeping it.
Okay. And I think probably the best thing to do is probably compare this, since this is called a value fund.
It's called
uncommon value. Well, value stocks are either large value stocks or small value stocks.
I would say these are large.
All right. And then what I would do is I would compare that to the large value indexes.
Okay.
All right? Which you can actually look up in the Wall Street Journal in the third section, I believe. I'm not sure I could put my finger on it that quick. But in the third section, if you take a look, you can actually will give you what large value funds have done. And
okay.
The first question is it at least performing at the percentage level of other peers in its category? That's question one. Either it is or it isn't.
Yes.
If it's underperforming, that would be a good reason to jettison it. If it is performing, now other areas of the market have outperformed large value. Small companies, small value has outperformed large value, but
yes.
That's not a reason to sell. If you need large value exposure, maybe you should keep it. So there's a couple of questions. One, is it at least doing as well as its peers this year? That's number one. And number two, does it represent an asset class that I need to have in my portfolio?
Yes.
Or do I already have that covered in my portfolio?
Yes.
Those are the two questions.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
Good luck.
All right. And I can find that in the Wall Street Journal in the third section.
Yes.
And this is called a large cap value. What?
It's just called large value or large cap value.
Okay.
You'll see it.
This is just a report.
It's, part of a giant table in the third section of the Wall Street.
Occurs daily.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. We have one caller remaining in about 3 minutes. We'll go next to a listener in McLean on line number four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I have a couple questions if we have enough time, but we'll start with one.
Okay.
One of them is, you were just talking a few minutes ago about mutual funds. What's a good percentage for management fees and all the fees and all the loads and all the stuff that comes with mutual funds? What's the minimum that's reasonable? Because even in a no-load fund, there's some fee that goes along with it. What's the best percentage to keep it below?
Well, if we're talking actively managed mutual funds,
mm-hmm.
again, where you have a manager trying to outperform an index, and we're talking about stock indexes,
mm-hmm.
then I think you will find that it's typical between 1% and 1.5%.
Okay.
For everything. If you are talking indexes, where you are simply going to index,
uh-huh.
I think you're going to find that indexes can be purchased as low as 0.25%.
Okay.
All right? So you have to compare the two.
Okay. So, and this is everything, including the manager.
That's everything.
Okay, everything.
That's everything.
Okay, if it's any more than 0.25% for index funds or 1.5%.
Well, it depends on what type of index fund, but the S&P 500, for example,
uh-huh.
you could index for 0.25%. And if you go to a large fund, an active money manager who really is doing the same thing,
uh-huh.
it might cost you 1% to 1.5%.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I had a fund that I just recently got out of because they started charging me $30 a year just to have the fund. And I had very little money in it, and I thought, forget it, I moved it. So
Sure.
The other question is, this is kind of awkward thing to ask, but at the university or the extension office, are there places where people can teach financing or home budgeting or household budgeting and things like that?
Where people can learn about that?
Yeah.
Well, I think you'd have to call the College of ACES. There are a couple of extension courses through the College of ACES that I think
mm-hmm.
cover that. So that's what I would recommend doing.
Yeah, and the University of Illinois Extension has advisors on those topics
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, see, I had heard you almost a year ago, and I've been trying to get hold of you because I was interested in helping out if someone wants. Because I know if you go to a financial advisor, I mean, we're doing the whole 10 yards, it's very expensive. And I don't know, I'm trying to find a way where I can help people out who want to do, some minor budgeting kind of stuff. So, a volunteer basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I would do, is I would call the extension office.
Okay.
Pleasure talking with you.
All right, thank you much.
Thanks very much for the call. We're out of time. We're going to have to stop.
All right, well, it's been a pleasure. And just for the lady who called just before this last call, large value this year is up about 13 to 14%. So she needs to compare that with how her funds or her UIT has done.
Very good. Well, there's much more we could talk about, but we'll just have to wait for next time. Our guest has been David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. He joins us always on the third Friday of the month to take your questions on personal finance. David Sinnoh, thanks so much.
My pleasure.